We're here to talk about a very sad situation, a refugee crisis that really is born in the Middle East, but is expressing itself right now in dramatic fashion in global media in Europe. Most of the refugees who we're seeing coming through Europe right now are from Syria, so they're fleeing the Syrian civil war. However, there are also plenty of refugees from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Eritrea, and from other countries as well. But I think we can say that, you know, the sort of origin of this is overwhelmingly the Syrian civil war, which began in early 2011, picked up speed during the year 2011, and then very quickly became one of the most, you know, horrific things we've seen in world politics in recent decades. And I think from watching the news, everybody has at least some sense of how awful that is. So throughout our talk here, we're going to give a number of facts and figures. We're going to look at some maps. We're going to talk about the number of refugees who are in the Middle East, the number of refugees who are streaming into Europe now. We're also going to talk about the politics of the European Union and of countries that are struggling to cope with this or deciding how they're going to handle this.
And Jamie, this is a problem that was sort of contained for a while. What exactly is it that's happened that sort of got it beyond the borders?
This was, you know, relatively contained. I mean, the Syrian civil war is so appalling that there are millions of displaced people within Syria itself. But we now have over 4 million, I think, moving more toward 5 million refugees now in neighboring countries. These are very dramatic numbers. 1.8 million in Turkey, 1.2 million in Lebanon, 628,000 in Jordan, and 248,000 in Iraq, which is a country that certainly can't afford to have new refugees given its dramatic instability, although we certainly could say that about Lebanon too. And there are really interesting differences among these immediately neighboring countries to Syria about how they have handled the refugee crisis in the last few years. And I could talk about that if you'd like, but at least this sort of sets us up. On this slide, we see a comparison, a visual comparison, of the refugee burdens of the countries neighboring Syria compared to the refugee burdens of countries in Europe. And what we see from this slide are very, very large circles on the countries surrounding Syria, indicating, you know, very large refugee populations, and much smaller circles in each of the European countries, showing that they've taken, of course, many fewer people. I would say about the European countries, two countries stand out as being more generous than the rest, and that those are Germany and Sweden. But one thing worth pointing out is that on a per capita basis, Sweden has been incredibly generous. Mm-hmm. But that's not true of most of the other European Union countries.
And we have to remember that the refugees, they have to get through several countries quite often to get to a place like a Sweden or a Germany that has been accepting
more refugees. And I'm sure we will talk about the politics and the legal aspects of all that. Mm-hmm. And then finally here we have another graphic that does much the same thing, but it's very powerful in its impact. We see the total pre-war population of Syria at 20 million people. We see that more than 7.5 million of those people are internally displaced. I mean, that's incredible right there. More than a third of Syrians are internally displaced, meaning they are homeless within their own countries. They've been driven out of their homes. They're not really in refugee camps. They're just making do wherever they can in an already war-torn country. And then, of course, we see, once again, the country-by-country figures of where the 4 million plus refugees who have escaped Syria are right now.
And we should point out that those who have been able to look at the slides, they've probably noticed the numbers are not always consistent. That's for a couple mm-hmm. of reasons. Number one, it actually is very hard to keep track of mm-hmm. folks given the volume of activity. But also, this is a very, very fluid activity that we're looking at, and these numbers change literally on a daily basis. Now, Anne, you, of course, like to point out that it's not just about Syria.
Right. And actually, I just want to follow up with one of the things that Jamie said, is that it's a fluid situation, but it's also a situation that's not actually, there's not a particularly clear indication that the situation in Syria is going to improve, and therefore this problem is going to be resolved. We refer to it as the Syrian civil war, but of course this is, as many civil wars historically tend to be, a proxy war to a certain extent. And in particular, you know, Russia has been involved there since the beginning, but in recent, you know, literally days, Russia has kind of intensified its support for Assad's regime, which means that essentially, I don't think that Russia has the resources to help him win definitively, but definitely has the resources to prolong this conflict indefinitely. And so we're thinking about the situation in Syria, where half the population is either dead, displaced internally, or has left the country. I mean, kind of the extent of human suffering and the fact that this could continue for quite some time. And so there's no hope that this will get resolved by the fact that that misery will end. Syria is not the only country producing refugees. It's certainly kind of dwarfing in absolute numbers the refugees that are coming in from other places. But it's kind of an interesting situation because they're, one of the things that we see emerging is the hierarchy of suffering. This has been going on for quite some time. We've seen stories about, you know, people coming in on boats from, you know, from Africa. The Mediterranean is kind of a graveyard, essentially, of all the people who have died, you know, thousands of people who have died trying to make their way to Europe. And it's interesting that sort of there's a certain amount of resentment that it's certain more photogenic deaths in recent weeks that have finally got both some policy changes and attention from the world community, that sort of, you know, dead washed African babies on the beach don't quite produce the same reaction as a lighter skinned, you know, baby, the toddler, you know, the dead toddler that has been pointed to as one of the turning points in the way that European powers started to look at the situation and the difficulties from that point on to ignore kind of this constant, you know, this horrific misery for hundreds of thousands of people.
And the map that's up on the screen right now actually does show that in terms of migration out of the central Mediterranean area, we are actually on pace this year to beat 2015 to actually have more migrants than 2014. And then when you look at the total number of people who are looking for asylum, while Syria still clearly is the country where this is happening the most, you'll see Afghanistan and you'll see Serbia and Pakistan, Iraq. Remember, Iraq, there were people going to Iraq to get away from Syria, which gives you some idea of how bad things are there. We've been using some terms. We've used the term refugee. I know occasionally we'll hear people use the term migrant because they think migration, you must be a migrant. But we do have to be careful about the terms we use, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And those are the two, I think, most important words to focus on initially. Generally speaking, a migrant is somebody who's on the move, who's, you know, gone from one country to another for any number of reasons. It could be fleeing war and persecution. But it also could be for economic reasons. It could be for any number of reasons. So migrant is the broader term. The more specific term is refugee. And this term is defined in international law and in a very important treaty from 1951, the Convention on Refugees, that's the guiding international legal instrument concerning people who are refugees. And this is a very now famous definition and very well established in law. It says that a refugee is someone who is outside of his own country owing to, and these are the key words, owing to a well-founded fear of persecution. A well-founded fear of persecution based on a number of reasons. It could be based on race, discrimination against their race, based on religion, based on nationality, based on membership of a particular social group or political opinion, which really broadens things out. And so anyone who has a well-founded fear of being persecuted on a return to the home country for any of those reasons is considered a refugee. So a number of the migrants are refugees, but of course some of them are not.
Mm-hmm. But language matters a lot. This is a conversation we have in history and political science quite a bit. Language matters, Anne.
And again, sort of this is one of the really interesting things that we've seen in the way that this humanitarian crisis has been discussed from the beginning, that the word refugee on the one hand has a very specific definition in international law. It's also a fairly evocative word that ends up getting used for certain effect. And so one of the things that we have to be that I mean, I personally wish journalists covering this would be more careful about is in the kinds of terms that they use, because words have meaning. And in particular, one of the things that we've seen, especially in recent weeks, Britain was particularly sort of noteworthy for this, referring to waves of refugees, of people seeking asylum as swarms, right? These swarms of people coming in, swarming masses coming in. And again, kind of that kind of language that evokes animals, pests, right? That evokes this kind of dangerous thing. I mean, there's there's a certain amount of underlying racism that goes with it, but also an effort to dehumanize a group of people, because once you dehumanize them, any sense of obligation towards them and kind of as human beings potentially diminishes. And again, sort of we've seen less of that in responsible politicians. We've seen less of that. They've been more careful with their language, again, just precisely because of some of the images that we've seen and the acknowledgement that these are human beings going through horrible, horrible, horrible experiences, rather than some kind of blight on Europe that is trying to destroy everything that's sacred in Western civilization.
And if you think about those photos we saw earlier, one of them's up on the screen right now, there is actually, they're what look like kennels almost. So when you use a phrase like swarm, it, although it's very provocative and it, in some respects, it is descriptive, you get an idea that there are a lot of people moving in a direction. There are these images that sort of change the meaning, whether intended or not. And Jamie, we've talked about this before in terms of the word genocide. Mm-hmm. Countries are very cautious to use words that have legal meaning like this. Mm-hmm.
That's right. I mean, using a particular word can invoke certain legal obligations, and that's certainly true in using the word refugee. Countries have legal obligations to accept refugees who do, in fact, have a well-founded fear of being persecuted if they are to be returned home. And we can talk a bit more about the sort of dynamics of all that. But sure, countries are reluctant to call certain people refugees because they don't want to invoke those legal obligations.
Mm-hmm. Is there, you mentioned a couple of countries in Europe, and clearly folks are moving toward Europe. Is there a cohesive response from Europe mm-hmm. right now?
No, there isn't. And there's some good reasons for that. It's very hard for the EU to act, for the European Union to act collectively. Let me just sort of lay out the picture first of all. As most of you probably know, many refugees have been coming up through the Mediterranean, as Andy showed us earlier, and increasingly in recent weeks through the Balkans, through Greece, through Macedonia, through Serbia, through other countries as well. And most notably in recent weeks, as we've learned in Hungary, right, coming through Hungary, and the government of Hungary has been adamant in its refusal to allow people to keep coming through the country. And Hungary, of course, has built a border fence, and we saw an image or two of that up on the screen as well. So of all the major receiving countries right now, Hungary is the one that is, by far the most obstinate in refusing to sort of take responsibility for people coming through. On the other hand, of course, you see countries like Germany. And Angela Merkel very famously about a week ago said that Germany will take all the refugees that come through. Mm-hmm. And has since had to start to backtrack on that for various reasons. We see that Germany now has put up some border controls, border checks at its border with Austria, for example. And in part, that's just a technical response. You have to be able to handle the large numbers of people coming through in some kind of orderly way. But in part, that's responding to the politics of the situation. Angela Merkel represents the Christian Democratic Union. That's her party in Germany. And her very close coalition partner, the Christian Social Union, is opposed to her policies. And so she and other people in Germany are as well. But many Germans have been very welcoming. So within individual countries like Germany, we have division of opinion. We also see Germany's position starting to harden a little bit after being very, very welcoming. And then we see Hungary at the other extreme. That just gives you at least some examples of what's going on now in the EU.
Anne, what are you saying?
I mean, it's very interesting to see the way that the different European countries are dealing with this. And of course, some have no choice, sort of by the luck of geography. For some, this is a more concrete problem. For others, it's a more abstract one. And certainly, geography does affect the way that the different governments, react to this. I mean, it's very interesting to see Germany and kind of essentially using this as an opportunity. And I don't mean this using in a bad way, but using this as an opportunity to kind of for some international image PR, right? I mean, given Germany's history in the 20th century, I mean, Merkel is very clearly, despite the fact that not everybody in Germany agrees with this, that she may have some political coalition issues that are going to arise from this, she is kind of showing tremendous leadership in the European and world community by essentially sort of saying that Germany has learned from past, historical miseries, and Germany is going to be at the forefront of this very important humanitarian effort. The interesting thing that we want to note is that there is some difference, right, between the way that the different governments officially respond to the situation and popular responses to this as well. So you have last weekend, right, throughout Europe, we saw a lot of large-scale demonstrations of people expressing support for refugees, sort of you know, hashtag refugees welcome, right? And there were lots and lots of pictures all over on the internet from different European cities that showed huge masses of people sort of waving very friendly signs, you know, and really trying to show that they are not opposed to people, you know, people coming in. People donating food, people donating, you know, supplies. There are all these amazing pictures of sort of Germans singing, you know, these actually anti-Nazi songs, you know, as refugees were coming in. Kind of, I mean, talk about kind of an amazing, amazing historical representational moment. So those are kind of really, really wonderful. At the same time, though, we also see kind of popular negative responses to this, you know, to this as well. In some countries, certainly more than others, but we also see demonstrations in various European countries against refugees, kind of clearly designed to make them feel not welcome. And in particular, we see we see this a lot in Eastern and Central Europe, right? Hungary, where the government's reaction kind of matches most closely some of the popular, you know, sentiments on this. I mean, the fence that that Jamie mentioned, right? There's something particularly fascinating about that fence because that was the fence that was one of the places that kind of has tremendous symbolic value when we're thinking about the narrative of freedom in Europe, because that was the fence through that Hungary opened up a little bit to allow East Germans to escape from East Germany in 1989, right? One of these historical moments of, you know, the leading towards the fall of the wall and the end of the Cold War in Europe. And to see that fence restored with razor sharp barbed wire to keep people who are trying to, find some, you know, let's say, you know, generously freedom, right? I mean, to kind of just on a purely symbolic level, kind of really, you know, really horrific. In Poland, there were some demonstrations where apparently some protesters were screaming, "We'll do to you what Hitler did to the Jews," while singing Polish anthems. And again, I'm not trying to say that everybody in Poland feels that way, but there's definitely a way in which certain nationalist right-wing elements in different European countries are capitalizing on the refugee crisis as a way to foment xenophobia, as a way to bring certain, you know, subsets of the population together against this threat of danger. And the fact that it's so concentrated in Eastern and Central Europe is kind of particularly disheartening, right? Because it's sort of, from a historical point of view, this is the region that benefited tremendously over the course of the 20th century from the generosity of other countries accepting refugees from those places, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, from a variety of suffering that they endured as a result of various man-made disasters over the course of the 20th century. And so to have a people who benefited from this policy tremendously, historically, to now sort of shut the doors and be at the forefront of not letting anybody in while couching this in terms of saving, you know, Christianity and protecting the purity of Europe is very disheartening from sort of the, you know, suffering does not make people better, right? The kind of that going through something horrible does not appear to transform people into more understanding, kind of humane people, which of course is a fairly depressing thought, as we move forward on this. And it'll be interesting to see kind of how this is going to play out as we move forward.
When we look at the different countries' responses, by the way, I agree with everything that Anne said there. I will add something here, though, that's a little different to put it into some context. I agree completely about how disheartening it is that East European countries, who benefited tremendously from refugee flows and whose many people were welcomed elsewhere in the world, not to accept refugees now. But when you look at it sort of from an analytical viewpoint, there are some reasons why it's harder for these countries to accept refugees. That is not to excuse the policies they're taking. But these are countries that, for a number of reasons, you know, were closed off for many years. There are very, very many fewer non-Europeans living in these countries, whereas countries like, for example, France or Holland or Britain, for generations have had people from all over the world, and they've struggled with these issues, and they've realized the tremendous benefits that immigration from around the world can bring. And so those societies are, you know, somewhat better able to sort of absorb people who are viewed as very different than are the much more closed societies of Eastern Europe. Again, not to excuse policies that really are heartless in so many ways, but I think there is an additional social and political challenge in those countries that most countries in Western Europe don't face.
Mm-hmm. And it raises interesting issues about sort of the culture of the EU, right? And
it does.
And what it means, and kind of the liberal values, the sort of the openness, the appreciation of diversity. I mean, if we think about these countries, that certainly, and I totally agree with everything Jamie said.
This is
these
great.
Talks are so much more interesting when you don't. don't
and
agree.
And these are, now again, you know, as a historian, I will say that the reason these countries are so homogenous,
right,
of course,
is
because
yes,
of some systematic policies that
yeah,
took place over the course of the 20th century in order to make them very homogenous, because they used to be, in the first half of the 20th century, they were pretty yeah, diverse. They're not anymore, and that's absolutely true, and some clearly cherish that lack of diversity and want to keep it, right? But and we see kind of the language that's used is so ugly, right? I mean, the sort of this idea that kind of literally saying we can't let Muslims in Europe. So I mean, it's interesting, right? That kind of the latecomers to the European Union, right? You know, are now positioning themselves as the defenders of the European idea, presenting Europe as a white Christian place, right? So these others, right, the darker skinned others, the Muslim others, the others, are seen as not welcome. And these countries kind of want to stake their political claim in Europe as the people who are going to protect Europe from, you know, from them, right? Which, of course, again, needless to say, when people from those regions were coming out, people were referring to them in all sorts of unflattering terms as well, right? Maybe not un-Christian, but certainly in various, you know, unflattering ways.
And there really is the issue of being able to handle that many people coming in quickly. Even if you're open to the idea of people migrating into the country and having a more diverse population, when you have that many people come in that quickly, even if they're simply passing through, there are expenses, there are things that have to be done that will complicate the matter, even if you want to be open and inviting.
That could be an argument, right? We don't have the resources for this. We would love to help. We don't have the resources for this. But that does not appear to be the popular argument, right? The argument is the other stuff, even though the economic one would actually be a very strong argument, right? Because why bring people in a place where there are not enough resources or infrastructure, you know, to be able to help them? So again, in light of having access to a good argument, the choice to go with the other reason why not, right, I think is very, very telling about certain kind of political culture issues in the region.
And Jamie, if you don't mind, there's a map up right now showing a particular migration route through Turkey and then into Greece, etc. You mentioned this earlier. In terms of the economic health and well-being of the countries that folks are traveling through, are they in fairly good shape? Are they falling apart right now?
The farther north, the better. if you're looking strictly at, you know, economic wealth. Of course, there's some exceptions. You know, Austria is very wealthy, Switzerland's very wealthy, but you know, most people who are on the move now seem very much to go, you know, want to go north to Germany, to Sweden, you know, maybe Austria as well. Many, of course, want to go to France or Britain. And of course, it's true that North European countries in general are, you know, much better off than Southern European countries. We've all heard about the long-term economic crisis in Greece, for example, and mm-hmm, Spain and Portugal. So. And the Balkans, of course, are not as well off as the rest of Europe. And then once you get into the EU, following these paths, you enter the EU, of course, in Greece, but then you exit again, and then you enter the EU again at either Hungary or Croatia, according to the map we're seeing here. Or if you take a more easterly route, then through Bulgaria and Romania. Mm-hmm. And so the farther north, the better if you're looking to enhance your economic prospects. Now that brings up a really interesting point, which is, and this takes us a bit back to the law itself. So do these countries have a right to sort of tell refugees, I'm sorry, you can't come in? And the basis of the 1951 Refugee Convention, and thus of international law, is the idea of non-forcible, that you can't forcibly return anyone. In French, it's the policy of non-refoulement, right? And the idea is you can't send somebody back to the country that will persecute them. So where does this put European countries? Well, one thing that I think hasn't been brought up very much is that none of these European countries, when we're looking at the refugee flows over land, are actually considering returning people to Syria or to Afghanistan or to Iraq. The issue is, should they be returned to or kept in a place like Serbia or indeed a place like Turkey? I would argue that these countries are not violating international law for the most part, although there's some interesting caveats here, because what's not permitted is to send someone back to Syria. But you know, but there are arguments to be made that you can say, I'm sorry, you've gone through other countries that are able to provide you safe haven, yet you've chosen to continue to move on to reach our border for reasons that aren't directly connected to your immediate safety and to your need to escape well-founded persecution.
But of course, some of those countries that have been passed through could make the argument, well, we're not sending you back, we're just helping you get on through.
That's true, and there's also fundamentally a question of inequity here, because of course, the countries on the front line of the Syrian civil war, And I just want to remind everybody, not all these refugees are from Syria, but so many of them are. I think it's fair to talk about this, and it's a good example nonetheless. The countries on the front line of the Syrian civil war, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and indeed Iraq, are facing just severe strain. And they have been following international law, and they have been as generous as they can be, for the most part, and they have taken in everybody who's come across the borders. Were they not to do that, they would be in violation of international law, and of course, it would be considered morally outrageous by most people. But these countries are straining under gigantic refugee burdens, and of course, you know, they vary, but they're all, you know, a lot poorer than European countries are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these countries, Turkey, Jordan, they're saying, look, why should we have to pay for all this? And what they say is that this is not a Jordanian problem, this is not a Turkish problem, this is a global problem, yet the rest of the world isn't caring, it isn't helping enough, it's forcing us to strain tremendously just to keep these people alive.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
And it raises, I'm surprised I'm the one bringing this up, but it raises some really interesting questions within the EU, right? Because part of the EU agreement is open borders between the different countries. And so there are some really interesting ways in which the shutdowns of the borders to keep the refugees out are actually violating various international agreements within Europe as well, that certainly raise some questions about, you know, EU.
That's right.
And possibly even its future, because, you know, kind of what is this about? Is this just about trade, or is this about something else, you know, mm-hmm. certain values? Can we keep borders open for some people but closed, you know, but closed for others? Does that still, you know, that still fit?
So the EU is a truly remarkable institution. Whether you like it or not, there's nothing like it in the world. The level of integration and cooperation among the 28 member states of the European Union is just unprecedented. And you can see this not only in having many, many common economic features, including, this is really quite remarkable, the harmonization of thousands and thousands of economic regulations, workplace regulations, et cetera, all written in exactly the same words for all the countries of the 28 member states, which creates, in effect, a very large single economy for the 500 million people who live in Europe. So that's remarkable, but it even goes beyond that. We know that many of these countries have a single currency. We don't really have time to get into that here. That's a separate problem. But many of them have that. But what really matters here, as Anne brought up, is the system of open borders that is known as the Schengen Agreement, and that involves most but not all of the EU countries, but also involves a few countries that are not members of the EU. And if you're a member of the Schengen group, you open your borders to one another. I mean, you really do. And anyone who's traveled in the Schengen area knows this. You'd be speeding along in a train from France to Germany, and there is no border stop. You just go right across the border. And that is just stunning. It's just amazing because countries jealously guard their sovereignty in today's world. And the norm, of course, is that countries always check people who are coming in and coming out. So with this shared open space, the moment somebody gets in just one of the external borders to the Schengen area, they have free movement throughout the entire Schengen area. And so this idea that countries within Schengen will start closing off their borders with one another.
Already started.
Started, that's right, is a fundamental threat to this European way of life, which has been highly developed over the last 50, 60 years.
But the idea behind the open borders was not that there would be millions of immigrants or of
That's
refugees
right.
coming in, excuse me. It was that literally I wish to spend a weekend in Germany, but I live in France and I should be able to get there freely.
That's
easily,
right. So it's intended to facilitate benefit. Business and, you know, I mean, and it's so much easier to do business, which makes, which has tremendously improved the living standards of people in the European Union, but also for travel, for work, for study. If you're an EU resident, you can work somewhere else, you can travel somewhere else without having to apply for a work permit. You can study in another country without any problems. It's really remarkable. But again, the moment this starts breaking down, it makes people question what European unity is all about. And moreover, this system only works if the outside borders are airtight. And now we see with refugees, you know, flowing across the border in Hungary, if you don't even know who's coming across your border, there are reasons to be worried. And one of the legitimate fears here, although there are many illegitimate fears, is that this is a national security problem. I mean, anyone who gets in, even if just some tiny, tiny percentage of these refugees, you know, have extreme views or are willing to do violent things, then Europe now, they now have sort of freedom to move around 26 countries.
Mm-hmm. Now, this, of course, is a panel discussion. We're supposed to talk about what has history taught us.
Nothing.
The historian just said nothing.
I
want to make
that clear. And we're done.
So that's the end of the panel discussion. Thanks for joining us.
I'll elaborate.
Are there any examples? Is this unique?
I'm so glad you asked. There are a couple of different comparisons that we can draw. The first one, and the one that I think is arguably most evocative, is looking at this as the worst refugee crisis in the world, especially in Europe, since World War II, right? And we're thinking both kind of World War II really broadly construed, right? The 1930s and post-Nazi rise to power in Germany, the World War II itself, and then the post-World War II refugee crisis. So by some estimates, about 60 million Europeans became refugees during the period of World War II. And what's particularly interesting, and why I think this makes for a really interesting comparison, is not, of course, just the geographical similarity. And you can see in some of the images kind of the really striking similarities of the kind of the plight of people that people experienced during that time and that people are experiencing now. But what's remarkable is that sort of the reaction was very similar, right? Nowadays, sort of when people look back at the refugees, especially if we look at the 1930s and the refugees from Germany and then other German-occupied countries in Europe, and in particular, not just, but in particular the Jews, right? Now they're viewed as sort of the good refugees, right? They're genuine refugees. They're the ones we should have saved but didn't. The kind of a certain amount of guilt over not doing enough for those people whose plight, as it turned out, was quite genuine. Their fear of persecution, quite real. And of course, the vast majority of the ones who were not, the vast majority were not able to leave, and the vast majority of the ones who were not able to leave, of course, were dead by the end of the war. And what's remarkable is that now they're the good refugees. Of course, 1930s, they were the swarms, right? We can go look back in the 1930s and the rhetoric around it, and they were the swarms that were coming in, and they were a threat to this, and they were a threat to that, the kind of the xenophobia and the fear, ethnic issues, ideological, they're communists bringing in an alien, dangerous ideology that's going to ruin everything. The nature of the objections is so remarkably similar. The language is so remarkably, remarkably similar. And so it's very striking that kind of here we are again, millions of people in danger, but we're still trying to decide, are they really refugees or are they just migrants sort of trying to get better cable access, at their eventual destination. Another comparison that I heard recently that I thought was really interesting was actually the post-Irish potato famine immigration into the United States, right, where you have a quarter of the population of a country leaving and going somewhere else. And of course, also interesting because at the time when the Irish were coming to the United States in the 19th century, they were also seen as the horrible sort of subhuman people who were going to destroy America and everything that it stood for. And then, of course, in the 20th century, sort of the Irish are certainly no longer that, right? I mean, kind of they're the model group of kind of, these great Americans. And so once again, we have the situation of panic and anxiety over, swarms of people that turns out to be misplaced in retrospect, but lessons learned.
Those of you who are here, those of you who are watching the video, you've actually been able to see photos that from post-World War II or from the World War II era that parallel the photos that opened up this talk quite well. Folks on trains, folks in buildings huddled together. Anne has done a very nice job of finding the images that help us see that these really are parallel events in many
ways. There's a lot of human misery to choose from, both from World War II era and today.
What is the best response? I mean, realistically, of course, this is a humanitarian crisis. We should be willing to help, but at the same time, you have to worry about the economic situation in your own country as well as the well-being of your own folks. Jamie has started to hint at this a little bit. What is the best response here?
Well, traditionally in refugee policy, there's been a sort of three-level hierarchy of how you're supposed to, ideally handle this. Generally seen as the best solution is having people return to their own countries once the situation has gotten better. As Anne suggested earlier, there's no end in sight for the Syrian civil war, and so this is a particularly intractable problem, and that option is not on the table. The second best option is resettlement in a neighboring country. And that's what we see Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq straining with in different ways. And they've used very different policies, which I can get into. It's very interesting as well, but I think I won't now. But the problem is that option is really in jeopardy now, too. And you may have read that the World Food Program is once again running very low on money to feed people who are living in those countries and the frontline states. And it's supposed to be the worst option and the least used option to resettle people in third countries more distant from the region. And so this is a last-ditch solution, but it's the one that we're all talking about because the two better approaches are not being handled. So what do you do about it? Well, the best thing you can do is stop the Syrian civil war, which, of course, sadly, is not going to something we can do anytime soon. The second best thing is to really put a lot more effort into helping people in frontline states. And frankly, the EU and others have a tremendous interest in doing this, because the better off people are in Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, et cetera, the less likely they're going to be to make a harrowing journey to Europe to try to make their prospects better. And you know, the funding that the US and the European Union, et cetera, have devoted to helping refugees in the frontline states is nowhere near enough. And our country and European countries can afford much, much more than they've been willing to spend. Obviously, any solution, any approach has to be multifaceted, right? I mean, you have to deal with events going on in Syria and try to find ways to help people who are stuck there. You have to, I think, much more aggressively help frontline states in handling refugees. And then, yeah, then there has to be some kind of burden sharing among recipient countries as to who is going to take in refugees. And one problem that we haven't even gotten to, but it's a big one in the European Union, is that European Union regulations say that the first EU state to encounter a refugee is the one who's responsible for the refugee. And that's a patently unfair policy, given, as Anne said earlier, the luck of the draw when it comes to geography. Portugal is not struggling with this, nor is Ireland, right? But, you know, Greece and Hungary and Italy are struggling with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad you said the word burden, because I think one of the things, you know, kind of a significant part of the conversation is, you know, that this is, even for those people who accept the fact that this is something that has to be handled, kind of this idea of this is a burden that we have to take on. And I think it's really important to note that certainly it is something that's kind of, in the short run, is a very costly endeavor, right? You, especially because, in particular, in the case of sort of the true refugees, right, the people who literally lost everything and have absolutely nothing, there's a lot that's going to need to be done for them. In part because, of course, the journey that they take is going to have, even if they were perfectly healthy when they started out, the journey that they take on is certainly going to have some negative impact on their health, both individually and in terms of various public health issues that go along with it. But the thing that doesn't seem to be discussed very often is that research actually shows that in the long run, this is not a burden for those countries that receive refugees. It's either beneficial or, at worst, a neutral economic impact on those countries. All sorts of studies show that these are people, given what they have to go through to be able to get to their final destination, these are sort of really hardworking, dedicated people that, once given the opportunity to work, become, you know, very productive and contributing members of society. Studies sort of compare refugee type people with immigrants, and kind of the refugee communities tend to have kind of a higher rate of opening their own businesses, you know, employment, and not, you know, take the jobs from the local population's kind of employment, but they take different jobs and have a positive impact on job creation. In the short run, if the humanitarian effort is being done properly, the money pouring into the communities, I mean, it transforms the refugees into consumers, right? So it can actually have a positive, again, kind of even short-run economic impact on those particular areas as well. And so I think it's, and of course the studies that are done, they're done on previous waves, right? So the refugees from the 70s, right? The refugees from the 80s. And of course, again, kind of in retrospect, these are all the good, they're the good ones, they're the productive ones, they're the contributing members of societies now. And it's important to know that at the time, they were also seen as a horrible burden, you know, potential, you know, source of destruction of everything, you know, that's sacred in society. And yet, you know, kind of a couple generations later, they prove their contribution, right? Kind of they make up the money that was invested in them and then some. And again, of course, in the short run, it costs money, but it's important to kind of make sure that we don't purely think of this as just kind of throwing money into a giant pit of human despair, but a potential kind of, if you don't want to do it for humanitarian reasons, you can actually do it as a strategic way to invest in human resources, especially in countries like Germany. Mm-hmm. Possibly that's one of the reasons why Germany is at the forefront, is that they can benefit from kind of an influx of young people, given their aging population and certain other kind of demographic patterns.
Although the irony is that Hungary suffers from one very important problem that Germany suffers from, which is a negative population growth. And so actually both of these countries are countries that could benefit a lot from more sort of working age, energetic people. And of course, to make this journey to Europe, as you've seen, many of these people are young, middle-aged people who will contribute to the economy for 10, 20, 30 more years. And in countries like Germany and Hungary and Russia and some others that have declining populations, immigration is the obvious solution.
Mm-hmm. There's actually, in economic development, there's a theory that says the best way to grow your economy is actually have your population growing. And you see that even at the local level, where cities want to grow and counties want to grow. I bring that up for this reason. this is not just an EU problem, although that's basically how we've been describing it. Mm-hmm. This is a global problem in many ways. Jamie.
Well, it really is. The UNHCR, the UN agency that deals with refugees, says that there are 60 million people worldwide who are internally displaced or are refugees. And we're focusing understandably on Europe right now and on the Syrian civil war, but there are gigantic refugee camps in Ethiopia and Kenya and other places around the world with many, many people. So it's a global problem. But it's also a U.S. problem, at least morally and politically. Let me give you a few figures here just quickly. First, the European Union, Frontex, which is the EU's border agency, has recorded 500,000 migrants at EU borders in the months leading up to January through August of 2015. So far this year, first 8 months of 2015, 500,000, 500,000 plus migrants at EU borders. That's 1/1,000th of the EU's population, that group of people. Now, I mean, that's, you know, that still there'll be many more people coming in, et cetera, but still it is a small fraction, 1/1,000th. Of the 500 million population of Europe. President Obama has pledged to take 10,000 new people. Well, that, I quickly did the numbers, but that's 1/50th. You don't have to be a math whiz to know this, but it's 1/50th of what Europe has dealt with in just this year, right? And then I did the calculation of, you know, according to U.S. general population of 330 million, and there were so many zeros in the calculation that I wasn't sure how to explain it to you. But we're talking about the tiniest drop in the bucket to accept 10,000 people from Syria. The problem, as the U.S. government has put it, although it doesn't say very openly, but when you talk to diplomats or U.S. government officials, they'll tell you the problem is that they're under laws that say they have to, you know, interview everybody, investigate everybody, so that not a single terrorist slipped through. Mm-hmm. But still, this is a humanitarian crisis, and if you let that kind of determination drive everything, then no one's going to take in anybody.
Yeah. But it is important to note that historically, there have been instances in the 20th century when the United States policy towards refugees has specifically singled out certain groups as sort of as automatic refugees. There would still be an interview process and there would still be a fair amount of paperwork, but at the same time, it was a very kind of streamlined and expedited process, right? And there are a number of groups that benefited from this, including, you know, Soviet Jews, for example, right, who very much benefited from this policy. Again, you know, people could have said that, you know, they might be communist spies coming in to ruin everything, to destroy everything. And yet, when there is a political will and a recognition that people kind of potentially are suffering, there even within our cumbersome and problematic, you know, system, there are still pathways to do that, right? And again, arguably, you know, not to diminish sort of the repressive nature of the Soviet, you know, the Soviet regime, but certainly people in the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s were not going through what these people in these images, you know, were going through, right? I mean, the depth of suffering and kind of immediate risk to life is certainly, you know, not on the same level. So again, so part of it, I think, is, it, you know, certainly, you know, there are national security considerations that have to be taken into account and so on, but we do have precedents for doing this. There just needs to be a political will and a lobbying group that is going to decide that this is something that's worth fighting for and making a big fuss about and then succeeding. Mm-hmm.
Jamie?
And as we know in political science, the hardest lobbying groups to form are ones that deal with widely dispersed people or people with very little political or economic clout. So while I completely agree with what Anne said, that's a big part of the problem, right? There's no one to really champion people in this situation. I mean, there are groups that do it, but they have very little clout as opposed to groups that are, you know, that represent much more sort of privileged and politically active and economically powerful sections of American society.
I do joke every now and then that we political scientists are reasonably good at explaining what happened, but we're not so good at predicting what will happen. And so now, Jamie, I'm going to ask you to predict what will happen. Do you see the U.S. Doing? I mean, we're basically in an election year without being in an election year yet. So the politics are different now than they would have been, say, 6 months earlier.
Right.
What do you see the U.S. possibly doing here?
Okay, so my big prediction is things will continue to be bad. I hate to say that, but
that's my line.
Way to go out on a limb.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, in fact, and likely to get worse because we have a presidential campaign year, and intelligent discussion of issues never improves and always worsens in a presidential election year. So, I mean, and add to that the fact that many, many studies have shown that Americans pay far less attention to international politics than they do to domestic politics. And while people have, I'm sure most people do realize there's this problem going on in Europe right now, you know, it hasn't hit home as any kind of major issue within the U.S. So in terms of U.S. politics, I can't imagine much changing now at all.
Mm-hmm. What do you see happening on the European front?
Well, I mean, I think that's different. I think Europe, Europe has to deal with this. It doesn't have any way that it can avoid it. What I think we're seeing is a cycling through of this. In the beginning, and this was very, very quick, right? Just a couple weeks ago or a week or so ago, Hungary became the bad guy, right? Because it was the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, has been saying all sorts of nasty things about refugees. And Germany, as I said earlier, was the good guy. And already, as we said at the very beginning, Germany has started to scale back on some of these commitments. So, you know, I think what's going to happen is that for political reasons, Europe is going to be unwilling to take everyone in who gets to the borders of the EU. And so I think that initial optimism about German policy and about Angela Merkel, whom I agree has been rightly praised for being very generous, I don't think that's going to stand. I think we're going to see walls go up, and I think this is going to be a fundamental challenge, not only to sort of the humanitarian policies of European countries, but it will remain, I think, a fundamental challenge to the European Union itself. I mean, not that the EU is going away anytime soon, but in the whole history of the European Union, going back to its founding in 1956, there have not been threats to the Union in the way that we've seen in the last 5 years with the Euro crisis that began with Greece and now with the refugee crisis. These are unprecedented, I would argue, strains mm-hmm. on the European Union, and it will be interesting to see how the Union handles it.
Are there other paths? We keep talking about moving north. Is there any possibility of refugees moving south or east or anywhere else, or is that really the viable option, Anne?
Well, they can go through Croatia and get blown up on mines left over from the, you know, war, those military conflict, and they're more likely to get blown up because, of course, they can't necessarily read the signs that say, be careful, there's still landmines here. So there's that. That's not north.
Well, I mean, there are plenty.
I'm just looking at a map.
Perhaps in a more serious vein, I would say.
I know you're serious. They are going through Croatia,
right,
and they are
that at
risk for blowing
That's
up.
That's very true. So in an equally serious way, I would say that there, of course, are other places to go. If you are truly fleeing a horrific war, as most of these people are, almost anywhere is going to be better than the country you came from. So I think ultimately the question is how the world will deal with this. I think Europe is not going to be looking very good in a few months as it closes off. But I think the world as a whole has an obligation here. There are plenty of other places to go. It's a lot better to be in Egypt than to be in Syria. It's a lot better to be in almost name your country than to be in Syria. So there are other options. And there are countries that could be taking on far more responsibility that aren't. For example, the rich monarchies of the Gulf, who don't seem to lift a finger to help anybody, even the people whom they claim to champion. For example, Palestinian refugees. For decades, you know, the rich Gulf monarchies have been, you know, complaining about how badly Palestinians are treated, but they don't do much at all mm-hmm. to help Palestinians or indeed to take them in. And so I think there are plenty of candidates for countries not as wealthy as Europe and countries as wealthy or wealthier than Europe to help out with this situation. It's not just something having to do with the Balkans and Hungary and Italy and Germany.
And of course, I mean, yes, anywhere is better than than Syria, but at the same time, for some of the oil monarchies, and they're not necessarily the most attractive destinations, in part because they are repressive regimes.
True.
And they're repressive regimes that have absolutely no interest in providing any kind of path to citizenship or any kind of rights, right? I mean, we can't even say that these mm-hmm. people are going to be second-class citizens. They're just going to be second-class, period, right? Some of it is, of course, the lack of will on the part of these regimes because they're not stable regimes, and certainly an influx mm-hmm. of, you know, foreigners could destabilize them, right? But also that people are trying to make the best decisions they possibly can for them. Where they want to be is democracy, are democratic regimes, right? They're not running there. They're not running to Russia. They're not running, you know, they're not running to lots of other places that in theory, you know, mm-hmm. are pointing, you know, that are, Russia, for example, right, pointing the finger at this as kind of one of the failures of the West, right? But people from Syria are not flocking, you know, if not flocking to Russia to save themselves from the horrors of the civil war.
That's a really good point, and I think we have to distinguish between the individual motives of refugees and broader policies of countries. So I would never blame any refugee for trying to get to the best place possible. Not at all. I mean, I can only imagine what it would be like to be in a position like that. at the same time, I think, you know, it can't be the same countries that always take refugees.
Right.
Not that these countries have been particularly generous in the first place, not that the U.S. has been at all generous when it comes to Syrian refugees. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these are complicated issues.
I'm not going to try to predict what will happen.
You're a historian. You're probably even worse at predicting than the political scientists are.
Bad things are going to happen. I'm great at predicting. My historical background makes me an excellent predictor. Everything is going to be terrible. But more specifically, what I want to say is what I think should happen, because on the one hand, I'm certainly not going to argue with political scientists about people paying attention to things during election years or pseudo-election years. But at the same time, I mean, there is a little bit of room, right? One possibility is reframing this as a national security argument. We know that people living in miserable conditions, right, these various detention facilities and refugee camps are people going into them are not going to be, you know, dangerous people. But the kind of years of desperation and horrible conditions make them for very attractive, recruiting grounds, right? So the argument can be reframed, fine, we don't care about this as a humanitarian issue. Let's think about this as a national security issue, right? Tying it to Syria, maybe less so, but refugees from Afghanistan, from Iraq. I mean, we can definitely trace some of the misery of those people trying to leave to perhaps some of our policies, right? And kind of this issue of responsibility for the consequences of our foreign policy decisions, you know, over time. The other one, and I think it's also connected to being election year, there's a lot of discussion about wanting to make America great, what makes America great, the concept of American, American exceptionalism. And it's possible, and I say this as an American and as a former refugee and as a naturalized American citizen. I mean, this could be one way of reframing this discussion of what makes America great and what makes America exceptional. What makes America great and exceptional is the fact that it has historically opened up doors to all sorts of people who needed it, who provided a home for them, who provided them with, care and opportunities. And for the most part, those people who had their doors open to them have repaid America with, by paying taxes, by being productive, productive citizens, and, with love and patriotism and all those other sort of less, quantifiable things. And perhaps it's time to sort of, when we think about what makes America great, we don't necessarily think about all the amazing contributions that various xenophobes or the Know-Nothing Party from the 19th century have, how they contributed to America, making America great, right? We talk about the different people who came from all over who put their talents to kind of this amazing use, right? If there were no refugees were not accepted, there would be no Google, right? The two founders of Google were, in fact, refugees. Steve Jobs, his dad apparently was a Syrian, right? I mean, so again, kind of the reframing of the argument about the greatness of America has a certain amount of potential for allowing us to look at this humanitarian problem in a different light. And this, of course, is obviously a tremendously optimistic view that I'm not convinced anybody's going to listen to. But I do think that there's a tiny sliver of hope if people would just think the right way.
Sometimes that's all we can get from Anne. It's a tiny sliver of hope. Jamie.
Tiny sliver.
I won't close on it with anything profound. I'll just say two brief things. One, I think it's important for us to learn more about what's going on. It's very easy to learn more about what's going on in Europe. There are a lot of great news sources, and I would encourage people to follow it. And not just what's going on in Europe, but of course what's going on in Syria and in the neighboring countries. Probably the best thing you can do to learn more about this issue is to learn more about how refugees are living and how they're being treated in Turkey, in Lebanon, in Jordan, and elsewhere in the region. Second thing is, if you really want to help, there are good organizations you can give to. And, probably the best way to learn about who's working there is to go to the website of the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. There's a wealth of information on the UNHCR website about refugees, not only in the Middle East, but all around the world, about how you can help, and about the various private groups, the partner agencies who are active in this kind of work.